you know, revolution, right? You know, and they're going to manga the whole nation. And abortion, right? Like, these were the two, and abortion rights, right? These were the two issues that the Democrats really pushed. On the first issue, again, like you're saying, we come back to this problem of, and it's really what it, to me, it symbolizes how out of touch the Democrats were. But again, it's like, if the general perception is that the institutions are corrupt, if the general perception is that the system is rigged, then having someone, having the threat of someone saying that they're going to basically blow it all up, even if they're not saying that, but if you're saying that, like if you're trying to defend, you're trying to defend those institutions that are perceived to be, you know, not functioning properly, and you're trying to defend them, and someone says, is saying they're not functioning properly, and they're going to completely radically change them, you lose a significant amount of pull in that kind of scenario. Because what are you defending? Right? Like, what are you, like, again, it comes down to a simple, like, who cares? Like, if everything's all screwed up anyways, like, if I'm not happy with the way things are going, then maybe they do need a big shakeup, speaking as, like, an average voter.
And that's how Trump was seen in 2016, too. He was just the chaos candidate. It was the shot in the dark to just shake it up. They didn't really, that was the perception, was anything but this. You know, we want something different. And, well, and that's what counts.
And that's what happened again, is the crazy thing, right? Like, looking at the numbers, you know, Trump didn't gain, Trump on the popular vote this time, but Trump didn't gain a significantly higher number of votes overall than he did in 2020. But the Democrats lost an enormous number of voters. The numbers keep changing because we can't, but I think somewhere I read recently it was 8 million or something like that, which is a huge amount. Like, that is an enormous lack of turnout for the Democrats. And that's because they clearly have not been able to tap into the issues that people care, or I don't even want to say the issues. It's like the vibe, the symbolism that people are concerned with. The other issue, obviously, being abortion, which is, you know, obviously, you know, a very big issue, and rightly so, for a lot of women voters. But unfortunately, I think that the lesson is that it was not a big enough of an issue, and that it was too, again, Trump's messaging has always been exceptionally populist, right? And by being populist, it appeals exceptionally broadly. Issues like abortion really are the kind of thing that a certain subset of voter groups will be really for or against. And most people don't have it that high on the list. Right. And so it's, again, not leaning. It's, again, you're being too, it's almost like you're being too direct. You're being too honest with what you want to do, what you want to say, what you care about, instead of just genuinely being like, stuff is not good, we make stuff better.
Like, if you're a voter that has sort of identified specific problem areas, like you want abortion restored, or you know certain things are wrong with like the economy, and, or you want something done about it, you want to see like positive policies being put forward, you would think that, because I think you might be right about the way that kind of is like too specific. You do need something as broad, or I shouldn't say that you need something as broad, but it seems that something broad and like relatively populist, like the way that Trump is messaging, is effective at getting a sweeping, it just covers a lot of ground very effectively.
One of the most interesting things I've read so far as a law article is that, you know, Trump has, this election, he didn't win the majority, but he's increased his vote levels, I think in some cases quite significantly, with, you know, African-American voters, with Latino voters, with the LGBT key voters, which is the probably the weirdest one. And so, again, it's this broad populist movement is just, like you're saying, it's just appealing. Like, it's just easy to be appealed to it. The other thing we haven't really brought up so much, this is obvious, is also Trump is entertaining. Like, he's just more, he's like, he should, like, I can't watch an interview with him. Like, I've tried multiple times. I can never get more than 10% through, because listening to him talk, like, in a traditional manner, or having a conversation that is ostensibly supposed to be serious, is, like, painful. Because he, sometimes I think he might have, like, a brain injury or something. Like, but he's exceptionally good at sound bites, and he's exceptionally good at creating memeable moments. And like we've talked about, with particular mediums, boom, like that is what you need.
That's almost like, cause so that plays into the, I want to call it charismatic element, but that would be a bit charitable to Trump, I think. So I'm going to call it the canadal element, because I think fundamentally that's what it is. And I'm like, canadal here means, it's kind of like an archaic term, but you can think of it as like, you know how Dawkins had the idea of memes? They're like little animals, but the environment is the mind, and then there is fitness for reproduction with those. Some of them survive, some of them don't, and they propagate kind of according to the similar principles of like, just under the similar constraints of fitness and stuff like that. Trump is very canadal. And the way that you know that is that many people can do a Trump impression. And because they've heard him so much, he has a distinctive style. You have to kind of slur your voice in a certain way. I don't know anyone who ever tried to do like a Biden impression and be funny, or like a Harris impression and be funny. There's just some kind of natural way for, and again, I'm attributing this to his just like general style of existing as a political figure. He just propagates. And when you get yourself in the minds of people, chances are that when your meme is closer to hand than the other person's meme, when it comes to the voting box, it's just as a matter of psychology. Guess who is more in the minds of voters? It's the people who people are imitating and making fun of, and who have been consuming a lot of just memes about, you know, like even a lot of people who are, I see people who are like very critical of Trump, you know, they admit he's funny. You know, he has this weird thing with, and see, I can spread it too here, right? He has this thing about the Phantom of the Opera. And he keeps going on about Hannibal Lecter. Like, what is going, what's up? I looked into it. I couldn't find an answer. Like, what is the rationale or the reason for that? It's almost like a petri dish for just getting in your head.
Well, earlier in the episode, this is interesting I wanted to bring up. Earlier in the episode, I talked about his looks, right? I said, you know, they've got this guy who has this terrible spray tan and this terrible hair, and he's up there, and it's like wild to me every time I see him. Like, how is this possible? And it actually was last night when watching it, the election, that it really clicked for me. I'm like, this is branding. Like, it's basically branding with a clown makeup on. And I know that sounds like that would sound like it's being like diminutive towards him, but it's like, no. It's super noticeable. And that is what is important. It's super, like you're saying, it's super replicatable. It's super memeable. It's super impressionable, right? His look is part of his brand. And yeah, the look is stupid and it's insane, but it sticks in your head and you know exactly who it is. And there's so much you can do with it as an average consumer of symbolism. Right. And there's ways like we're doing right now, it is almost impossible to not take it and spread it. That's like a weird orange virus.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
That's the thing about memes, is they spread when you try and talk about them. I've had that. So like, this is kind of a side tangent, but like in my own thinking about trying to talk about advertising and like, how would I write a book about this, or how would I put together a lecture on this? I've realized you can't put any live specimens on the table, or else you spread the ad, right? Or else its effect plays itself on you. How do you analyze an ad without how do you analyze an ad without, you know, in particular, without it spreading it to the students in the class, right? How do you talk about Trump and specifically what about Trump is propagative or canadal without, you know, itself propagating it? It does have that effect.
And, you know, all of this, you know, makes me think a little bit of, just on a kind of elementary level, you know, it does bring up questions about the suitability, but I don't want to say there is a way you can approach the happenings of today or of last night in our current political climate and seriously ask, what is the suitability of democracy in the 21st century? And obviously that's like a really controversial thing to bring up. And we mean, oh, like, well, what are the alternatives? Like, bracket that question for a second. You know, it makes me think a lot about, you know, Plato's criticisms of democracy, right? Which is effectively like what a lot of people are saying right now, which is that it's very easy to get people to make decisions and get basically the populace on your side on issues that are either incorrect, that's the wrong decision, or literally don't matter or just made up. Like, and when I say made up, it's like if people are effectively voting largely on Trump's persona, then they are not really voting for the president. They're not really voting for that position. They're not really voting for a particular active and engaged and actual political movement. They're voting for some guy.
Yeah, they want someone in the White House who they trust is, you know, keeping it happening there.
It becomes a popularity contest. And if that is how, you know, modern democracies actually function, you know, that's clearly concerning because there's not really any connection between a popularity contest and a political figure making responsible decisions. Now, I'm not saying that Trump isn't going to do that. I'm not saying that Trump is actually going to do a bad job or whatever it is. Obviously, a lot of people think that, but I'm saying that, like, you know, this sort of system that is so clearly operating on symbolism to like such a high degree is deeply disconnected from the actual world by virtue of it being highly symbolic. And what does that actually mean for, you know, eventually Trump has to walk back in the White House and actually run the country, right? And those symbols don't really matter anymore in that kind of decision-making process, at least not in the same way.
No, yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is you just have to, there's a certain fitness to what the image has to do. And once it succeeds, well, then you can almost cast it off. I think that, in 2016, a lot of what he did contributed to the image and the persona that got him elected in 2024. But that's not an option after this. He just has to. This is what's kind of, I think this was what the Democratic Party messaging was kind of centering on, was there's no holds barred here. After this, there's no more terms available to him, unless, of course, he does some crazy stuff and keeps himself in office or something like that. But the point is that if there was any kind of survival instinct, you can put it on the table that, like, that's not here anymore. Like, he doesn't have to maintain an image after this. He can just do.
Yeah, and I think the symbolism aspect, you know, this is really what the conversation we've been with that has come to a lot. But I think that that's, you know, again, really like brings in questions of what is the suitability of current democratic systems when symbolism is the driving force behind, you know, democratic institutions, the decisions they make. Like, you bring up a good point, right? Like, Trump is not necessarily, he probably doesn't necessarily have to worry about a future term. He's only got, He's got a 4-year term now. He's got a 4-year mandate. He is quite old. If I'm trying to remember now, he's what, his early 80s. So he's going to be in his mid to late 80s by the time he's done the second term. There isn't really anything that's holding him back from making whatever kind of decisions he wants, largely in part because his perception is so his public perception is so heavily disconnected from his policy perception. Like, actually, I want to take that back a little bit. They're definitely associated, but on the detailed level, like, he has made himself, he has made his symbolic aspects resonate really with only a couple policies. And those policies are more like, I hate to say it, but use the word vibes, right? The kind of vibe for America, the kind of vibe for American politics, right? Obviously, immigration and border issues is like the perfect example. Like, that is kind of what, that's one of his keystones, much like the Democratic Party in this past election made abortion, like, that kind of keystone issue thing that they're going to fight tooth and nail for. His has been and continues to be border issues, which I think, frankly, has a broader aspect of support, especially in areas that are his base, like the South. It's very clear that, like, he can make whatever decisions he wants to make going forward. He doesn't, there's far less of a disconnect of what people are going to accuse him for, at least in ways that he actually cares about. We talked about this kind of inbuilt, you know, sort of systems he's been using, the Republican Party and his, particularly the MAGA Party, has really utilized. They don't need to be concerned with criticism in the same kind of way, because, like, they've built up this, you know, this sort of perception, this symbolic movement, you know, they've built up a really strong utilization of current media in a particular way that is, again, disconnected from deep policy discussion, right? Trump does great on social media. We've talked about this before. Social media is a terrible place to discuss policy in a detailed and thorough manner. Coming back to people like Marshall McLuhan or whoever else we've discussed before, it's like, you know, Instagram is great for sharing memes and photos of hot people and travel pics and things that you know, your wants and desires, basically. It's not a great space for sharing complex arguments on why you should take this or that stand, right? And that kind of leads me a little bit into the final thing I want to talk about, which is that, you know, earlier I mentioned that, you know, my online media consumption definitely trends left, right? You know, being on, particularly like I use stuff like Reddit. So I'm going to use the example of Reddit quite a bit. Reddit up until election day, and really since 2016, has been full, like constantly full of people talking smack about Trump and people posting, making posts and linking articles and discussions around, you know, his policy decisions that are perceived to be, you know, racist or bigoted or whatever it's going to be, his policy decisions and previous life choices and business decisions or whatever that are perceived to be corrupt, both like from a business perspective and, you know, from decisions made in his personal life. Apparently there's been discussions constantly about basically how he's a buffoon, right? Like, he says and does stuff that is like stupid and that is totally ignorant, and he makes himself look like an idiot, and he looks like, you know, and he's like the orange, people call him the orange man and all this kind of stuff. This is certainly not a new term people have been discussing before, but echo chambers are a very real thing online. And Reddit's a very, very, very large site. It's one of the biggest social media platforms in the world. It's one of the biggest platforms for current public discourse. But it is still, I came to realize, highly insulated. Our different media avenues, our different areas where we engage with symbolism and political discourse, because often the two are melded together in the same space, unfortunately, they can be incredibly insulating. And so you would think, if you were on, like, if you were seeing what I was seeing on Reddit all the time, you'd think that, oh, most Americans hate Trump, right? Like, you know, there's 800 comments about how awful he is, and then at the very bottom, there's a few heavily downvoted comments about, you know, how amazing Trump is, or how he's going to get all of you, or whatever it's going to be, right? Clearly, that stuff did not have the impact that people thought it did. Like, clearly, it did not actually matter. I think this ties in with, like, very large-scale democratic institutions and activities mixed in now with the sort of media systems that we utilize, where it's very easy to perceive that you are on the popular side and that the things that you believe in are popular and that the things you believe in are obvious and the things you believe in or want to happen will happen, because it's so easy to get an enormous amount of reinforcement in that belief within the media sphere that you inhabit. But the correlation between those two, between the media sphere you inhabit and how things actually play out, is often very, very wide in its difference.
I remember we had a discussion and we mentioned, or we were having a discussion about media and propaganda in relation to Israel-Palestine. We kind of dichotomized Reddit and Twitter, whereas Reddit was more long form, it's kind of forum based, and it seems to lean more pro-Israel. Reddit is more imagistic, there's less text, but you can fire off a feed really quick and you get a lot of images and you can transmit video a lot. And at least in my experience, Twitter seems, or at the time when we had the discussion, a lot of the posts that I was seeing on Twitter were pro-Palestine. So I just find it, first of all, I find it interesting that Reddit siding kind of with Trump in that way, because, I mean, the Republican and Democratic Party both are quite pro-Israel, but the point being that, or actually, no, yeah, but the point is that there is this kind of, because the point that you're going to is that it's very easy to find yourself perceiving a consensus where there isn't really a consensus. In a certain way, you know, I imagine like people who aren't on social media would kind of just be like, well, obviously, like you walk into a room and you're going to be surrounded by four walls. Like, what were you expecting? But at the same time, it's not a very charitable reading in terms of the integration of social media into the way that people commit to political discourse, especially using the internet and social media as like a primary mode of political discourse, right? Like, and I think this speaks to I feel like I'm trying to make a parallel between the anti-establishment reading and kind of revive it, but not from like a anti-elitist standpoint, where it's like the modes of public discourse that, and maybe it's different for me too because we're in Canada and politics doesn't exactly have the fanfare and flair that American politics does, but when I think about like what does a public mode of what does a public mode of political discourse look like? Well, in America, it's your, you know, there's certain towns that have certain cultures, they have certain peoples, they have certain opinions, and they vote a certain way. And in what is the public mode of discourse in that? It seems to be a kind of neighborly discussion or going out and experiencing people. I feel like that's the thing that, you know, social media adult people kind of see as like the antiquated way of going about having discussions is going out and talking to your neighbors or knocking on doors or something like that. But that really does seem to be the indicator if the perception that you have on the way things go doesn't line up, or at least within social media. Like if you're trying to reconcile your perceptions of everyone finding Trump ridiculous and then Trump wins, well, there you need to consider that the avenue of discourse that you've engaged with on social media, again, I'm elaborating the point that you made, but I'm trying to tie in this idea that there are other, I don't know if they're non-technological, but there have to be places where people are having these discussions, right? Where people
Sometimes there's almost like some self-awareness on Reddit. It's like people talk about how like people even bring up the average Redditor, particularly the average Redditor in these more politically oriented subs and discussions, is not the average American, right? But media systems, especially social media systems, are so, they're very what's the word I'm looking for, kind of manipulative or delusion inducing, there's a better term, but delusion inducing in that they are still so big and the system seems so broad that it seems as if it has to be a reflection of on the ground political diaspora. But as you're like highlighting, there is this whole other world out there, and this whole other world also happens to include the majority of voter types, right? Like you're saying, working people in smaller towns who are probably more like middle-aged to older, or are younger people in those towns who identify as heavily blue-collar, especially because they've grown up with a certain kind of Trump movement, right? So they have grown up with this anti-establishment kind of vibe, and that has really started to kind of color the whole picture that people are concerned with. And it's a picture of the world that is very different than exists on the left-leaning social media platforms that people get kind of sucked into as being reflective of the real world. But with that, it's been a really interesting discussion post-election. This has been the Canadian Philosophy Show. I've been your host today, Hale, and with me has been Brandon. And we hope to have you next week for a more regular philosophy episode.
philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Did you know the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, aka SFPERG, has been leading social and environmental activism on campus for 40 years? SFPERG is student activism, by students, for students. Do you have a vision for a brighter future? Are you passionate about changing the world? Visit us at www.sfperg.ca. That's www.sfpirg.ca to learn more about getting involved today.
This is Bird Note. Nesting bald eagles like their privacy. But how much space between one massive nest and the next can vary a lot, and it often depends on the food supply. Bald eagles nest near water to hunt fish and water birds, and their nesting territories range from 2.5 square miles to as large as 15 square miles, depending on how much food there is. Red-tailed hawks nest in diverse habitats, from forest edges to canyon cliffs. A pair will typically have a nesting territory of about 0.5 mile to a full square mile. Cheer falcons in Finland and Scandinavia really need their space. And once again, prey plays a crucial role. They feed on pheasant-like birds called ptarmigan. And ptarmigan numbers fluctuate so wildly from year to year that raising young gyrfalcons is a real challenge. The last thing these birds need is competition from their neighbors. In one research area, their enormous nests were found, on average, just once every 175 square miles. That's like one nesting pair in the whole city limits of Chicago. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.